This is an example of speech.
Welcome to Tell Me What to Think, a free from oversight and free of charge, thoughtfully improvised, expletive deleted, details expanded, whistle blow hard evergreen topical heat wave of a weekly conversation turned podcast, in which we discuss politics, global affairs, current events, music, literature, social media, and anything else that bubbles up from the unmoderated comments section in our brains. We urge you to join us and tell us what you think. To listen to the archives, go to stoneduckmedia.com or tellmewhattothink.com. You can contact us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. I'm Peter Elbro. You can contact me on Twitter at bloatednemesis. And I have with me, as always and forever, Charles Minnick, who is on Twitter at green_weird, which is W-Y-R-D. This episode, we tell you what to think about the state of progressivism after the 2018 midterms. Prepare to get righteous and reactionary. This is Tell Me What to Think. Time to get on our soap pod and tell you what to think.
Signed with a shake and a smirk, centralized states can turn a blind eye. Those who benefit never ask why. Just sit back and enjoy some cocoa beans and don't wonder what profit really means.
Are recording. All right, welcome everybody back to another week of Tell Me What to Think. This is Tell Me What to Think about progressives post-2018 midterms. Quick housekeeping, www.stoneduckmedia.com, and what was the other one? Tellmewhattothink.com?
Yep, that should be, I'll get that working today.
Find us on Twitter, you know the handles, it's in the introduction. And email us at tmwttpod@gmail.com. All right, so.
And there's Facebook.
And Facebook group, Tell Me What to Think podcast. Yeah. So, we are discussing, where do the progressives stand post-2018 midterms? Not only were the 2018 midterms a, you know, in the word of the president, a referendum on him, although he probably didn't use the word referendum.
We're going to see a red wave.
Yeah. You know, it's like, if this election is about me, he said. But I think also, it was kind of the first time to take the case back to court of progressivism's role in the Democratic Party since the 2016 primaries, you know, because that also was an unsettling result for many people. Sure. People continually want to also relitigate a fucking primary from 2 years ago. So,
man, there's still a lawsuit about that shit going on, so whatever.
So there was a, the midterm elections, which I don't think as directly, like, pitted these wings of the Democratic Party against each other. I don't think you can
macro scale.
Yeah, I don't think you can take any like direct electoral results from the midterms. You could take isolated, I guess, primary results.
But those only tell you about the district.
Yes. Yeah. Of course. So we were just talking about, there's a Brookings study that said 44% of the primary candidates in the 2018 Democratic primaries identified as progressives, which is up from 29% in 2016. I have a feeling, by the way, that number might be up from 2 years before that, too.
Oh, of course. A Bernie bump, right?
Yeah. And I think it's just, get into other things. I don't want to go back to 2014. That's, we're just talking too much. Let's not worry about that. We can point to specific election results.
We might as well point to the ones in our backyard because Wisconsin's first was an interesting microcosm of a lot of the factors that are affecting progressive politics currently.
So you're talking about Iron Stash.
Right. So the problem with, one of the big problems with Iron Stash is that he was not exactly a helicopter candidate, but he was sponsored by a group that's trying to make itself, you know, more widely powerful among progressive circles, and that is the Working Families Party.
Mm-hmm.
So from what I've been able to observe from my own personal view of things is that the Working Families Party established in the past couple of years, established six branches, one of them being Wisconsin. And mm-hmm. very early on, they sponsored Randy Bryce in a big way. They were sending their resources to get him elected.
Can I throw in, before you continue, that, because you may not know this, I'm only going based off of how he was introduced at a rally I saw, which was a Bryce Iron Sword rally. Mandela Barnes, yeah, interesting. Mandela Barnes, I believe, is Working Families Party.
I mean, he was, but not sponsored like them in the same way.
Well,
wait, was he working for Wisconsin Families Party? I thought he was an activist for.
He was introduced at that rally. I don't know what exactly his association is, but he was associated with it. Like, I think maybe in the lieutenant governor's race, he might have been the Working Families candidate. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there because it is just interesting to me that someone associated with it is actually in office. But go on about them.
Okay,
I don't know much about them.
Well, it started off from New York. They're, of course, a New York thing. They were behind Ocasio-Cortez, and they've had some success in other races in other parts of the country. But
yeah,
Randy Bryce was, I mean, not necessarily a flawed candidate. In a sense, like, he obviously wasn't, like, Missouri's governor flawed.
That's a low bar, but point taken. Yeah, I agree. No, he didn't have any, I don't think he had anything that was a glaring weakness that at the very least isn't easily, like, that isn't possibly also a strength.
Yeah.
So, like I think his, I think to some voters, something like the blue collar thing is a strength, and to some, that's a weakness. It's like, okay, yeah, you've been working as an iron worker. Why aren't you a lawyer or a whatever?
And
I think both positions are whatever what they are. They're valid and they're just different.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, and so he wasn't able to win, and you know, I kind of like to examine that in a little bit more detail. Why? I mean, was it the personal attacks? Do you think? I mean, he didn't win Racine, which is. If memory serves, the largest, you know, voting population in the entire Wisconsin's first district.
Mm-hmm.
I know Wisconsin's first district has been packed and cracked in some very significant respects by tacking on that southern bit of Waukesha and Milwaukee counties and removing Beloit from the district, which makes it far less liberal than it otherwise would be. I mean, for instance, Rock County for the governor's race went for the Democrats by like 16 points.
Yeah. Yeah, and they have sliced out, though, of Rock County from the first district, the, you know, those 16 points or whatever it is. I think it's hard. It's a hard case study to draw even many conclusions about Bryce himself without, you know, like a study that no one's going to finance. And because you can't even do the simple comparison, I don't think, of him to prior Democratic candidates.
We haven't had a serious Democratic candidate in the district in 20 years since fucking Ryan first started taking power here.
And so. Those people were going against, you know, not the whole time, obviously, but at least the past few cycles against a very nationally popular and powerful and wealthy Speaker of the House.
I mean, that was only his last couple of elections. Paul Ryan was not
popular. That's what I'm saying. But I mean, the best way to draw like kind of like 538 Nate Silver type conclusions is to like, okay, well, what happened in 2016, 14, 12, you know?
Yeah.
And ever, you know, at least those, since those elections, he either was or has been a vice presidential candidate. And then Speaker of the House, you know, like he has advantages that few other congressional Republicans have in the entire country over the past few cycles. Mm-hmm. And so, so on the one hand, it's like Bryce did do better, but on the other hand, you'd expect anyone to have done better. And since he didn't go against Paul Ryan, it's hard to isolate him as a candidate, because then you're also changing who he's running against, which in this case is not, it's
Ryan Stile is not exactly a paper candidate. They did appoint him to the Board of Regents, so he does have some
bureaucratic he is kind of like a just like generic brand Republican. Mm-hmm. And in many ways Paul Ryan was too. He just was a top of the, you know, an apex generic brand Republican. He was a name brand Republican. He went from generic bland Republican to name brand Republican, but the same product.
He was willing to say whatever they wanted to say about welfare and social entitlements and how they were destroying our country, but that's besides the point. You would think that Randy Bryce being a counter to that would have been more popular. But
yeah.
And Brian Stile, I think one of the most interesting things about his campaign was that he tried very hard not to stake out any concrete policy positions.
Especially on the Trumpian policy things.
Yeah.
Immigration. Oh, man. Hearing him, he had the same, like, three answers at the debate about immigration. It was, like, word for word. He's just like, here is my stock response. Quit asking me about this. And
I'm not going to say anything meaningful about this.
No, that's exactly it. He very clearly took both sides of the issue. He's like, we should love everyone. Everyone's, should be treated respectfully and, you know, are human beings. And on the other hand, we have laws and criminals must be punished. It's like,
wow.
We must move forward, not backwards, but maybe backwards and not always forwards.
Was he Jack Johnson or John Jackson?
Yeah, exactly. So he was very bland.
The personal attacks, I mean, was that what gave him such a huge advantage?
Well, I was just about to say that one of the best matchups, I think, that a politician could have if you're bland is against someone who is a flawed personality in a very, like, you know, like proper society sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's essentially the platform of the bland, like, upper middle class to upper class Republican with an education, white Republican male, you know, is, you know, well, I've never been divorced. I'd have never had child support payments. You know, I've never had drunk driving arrests. And like, none of those are in and of themselves, even taken at the worst possible way. I don't know if those are even, like, especially being long ago, like, I don't know if that's even something that preclude someone from being a congressman. But they were unfair. I mean, like, the things talking about dealing with his ex-wife and pay alimony and all that stuff were just like, she publicly said this is bullshit. It's like, there's nothing more you need to hear after that, in my opinion.
Right? He was like, as I recall, it's like, he was on unemployment at the time and we were going through problems, so yeah. Okay, I guess what really makes me furious about, and why this should be a warning case for all progressives and really everybody in politics everywhere, was that Randy Bryce, I'm looking at ballotpedia.org's campaign finance data about the race, and it looks like Randy Bryce, like, got, what, 5 times as much money as Brian Stile?
That's crazy, yeah.
Yeah, just over $7.4 million. With 6 3/4 spent.
So what are you implying?
I mean, it's just, I mean, that money was wasted.
Yeah.
I mean, that's terrible management. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to slice it, but if you can't buy an election in not a very complicated fucking congressional district with $7.5 million, then I don't know what to tell you, man.
Interesting.
I mean, well, I'm thinking about the money leadership fund. So Paul Ryan's Congressional Leadership Fund spent $2.7 million, and that kind of makes up the difference, but not really.
Yeah, I mean, at some point there's diminishing returns on money spent, but yeah, I mean, still, that much less is noteworthy. Mm-hmm. Think of all the money wasted on. I mean, I don't want to challenge him. Whoever you know, hey, freedom. You get to spend your political dollars according to the Supreme Court, however the hell you want to spend them.
Right, that's speech. We can't. That's like the most American freedom.
But the most, how much money was wasted in Texas on Beto was like the most.
Yeah, and that was insane. How could you spend that much money and still lose to Ted Cruz?
I mean,
that's what happens when you prevaricate and change your policy positions halfway through. Because Beto was like clinging to that like hard left progressivism during the election, and then softened his stance in the general, and it got him absolutely fucking nothing. Just like Gillum in Florida.
Yeah, yeah. So that's an interesting point. Let's dwell on this one for a bit. So,
okay.
And I'm sure it'd be easy enough to find a candidate who did soften some of their rhetoric in some race somewhere, but there are these high profile examples, and I don't think it's hard at all to go look back and find many others over the past decade of people who kind of moved to the center for the general election mm-hmm. and softened their rhetoric. And
lost.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's a pretty big deal. I think they had a deck stacked against them in both cases. I think it would have been a upset had they won. But, yeah, this thing where they think that they're making up some sort of difference in the general election by doing this, time and again, it's like the prevent defense in football, right?
Yeah, it never works. I mean, you're just playing catch-up. And I mean, the reason fucking defense isn't, I mean, to continue the football analogy, like you have to attack. Like you can't just be in the backfield waiting for the ball to come to you. You have to like send four or five blitzers across the line to try to snatch it. And compromising doesn't get you that pressure.
It really does not seem to. And now I think there are, though, examples of people who just, like, they were born compromised. You know, they sure. They just are that way. And I don't think we're talking about them. We're talking about people who aren't really being genuine by moving to the center. Or we're had a long record of being disingenuous as a progressive, possibly. But one of the reasons I want to do this show is because I have been kind of enamored with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I don't think when we talked about her, 6 months ago or something on the show, I don't think I said a negative word about her, but I wasn't really, like, enthused. Like, I was like, okay, yeah, like, super progressive person wins from super progressive district. Yeah, they took out an establishment person, but it didn't really, like, I was reluctant to put her on a pedestal, not because she hadn't earned it, but because, like, I don't know that she would want it, that most people in that situation would want to, like, put themselves out there. She is not that way. She puts herself out there and does not fucking compromise.
Mm-mm.
And it is refreshing in a way I can't point to anyone else being like it. Honestly, she does it, like, Bernie is way more of like rhetorically a centrist than she is.
Yeah, stodgy almost by comparison.
Yeah, like he's always like choosing his words carefully, and she, I would say, like,
I mean,
she does choose her words carefully. She just isn't doing it in a compromising way.
Right, she's not appealing to the center at all, and because there's virtually no reason to.
Yeah, but no, and the thing is, nothing she said, looking with my cynical eye, nothing she said is really, like, in any way, shape, or form crazy. And she actually is really great at when people try to, like, find things that she says that are crazy or out there. She then, like, will, like, retweet them and, like, point out how they're being ridiculous or whatever. And it's like, she's like a master at rhetoric. It's it's really refreshing to see, and it's getting shit done.
It is. I mean,
she's not even in office yet.
Yeah, they've gotten all of like what several co-sponsors for her Green New Deal. Mm-hmm. Instead of like listening to a bunch of boring speeches, she spent her first day protesting Nancy Pelosi's office.
Okay, but she also then, she has spent a lot of her time, because she's also kind of open about what the hell she's doing, you know? Mm-hmm. She has spent a lot of her time working on building support for this Green New Deal and a, I can't remember the exact, like some sort of temporary committee that would work towards this legislation.
Yeah, the select committee.
And she knows she has not spent, I mean, you bring up that she protested Nancy Pelosi's office on the first day, which Nancy Pelosi got the fucking message, and then she's like, we can work together. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has not been spending the past month in this, like, totally, like, brain-hemorrhaging news political battle of, like, who should be the speaker. She's like, I'm going to work on this select committee.
Yeah.
And she just didn't get involved in it, and because she's like, I got support from the speaker on this thing I want to do, so now I'm going to try and get it done.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I guess it does in a way matter who's the speaker, because...
No, yeah, I don't want to diminish it. Yeah.
Willing to compromise for fucking nothing, but... You know, I mean, she's... Okay, I will say, I did call Ocasio-Cortez on the Ways and Means Committee. Pat myself on the back for that one.
Yeah. So wait, is that official or?
Yeah, she's definitely seeking a seat out on the House Ways and Means Committee, because that, I mean, we might as well have our most progressive stalwart in the most important spot. I mean, sure, it's boring and super, super boring, but she has a degree in economics, so she knows what she's talking about and is, you know, willing to bring her prestige and popularity to what is ultimately going to be the center or the... Yeah, the center ground, or the central battlefield of all progressive politics for the next 4 years.
Okay, so now let's parlay this into how, because of this speakership battle, the way that the progressives got involved, which I called, this is my, I called it, Mark Pocan... And I don't have, is it Premia, Representative Premia Jayapal, I believe?
Premia Jayapal?
Yeah, the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus.
Washington? Washington 6th, if memory serves.
And so our Representative Mark Pocan from Wisconsin. They're the co-chairs, and they essentially negotiated with for their support for Pelosi to, we get... not just more representation on committees, but a sort of representative representation, which is like they are whatever percent of the entire Democratic caucus. So they were like, hey, we should be represented on these important committees with the same, that same percentage or near that percentage. Because now part of it, as I think was pointed out in an Intercept article, that a lot of the, progressive caucus members don't really seem to want those jobs, like you're pointing out with Ways and Means, but those are, I'm trying to think of some old man metaphor for, that's where the rubber meets the road in Washington, is something like Ways and Means. And having
progressive, it's made.
Yeah, there you go. And, yeah, have, ugh, yeah, sausage. And having progressives on those important committees, like, I think the House Intelligence Committee, of which, you know, it's kind of in the news a lot with Nunes and Schiff, I think had zero or one progressive caucus member on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one that Pelosi picks herself.
Of course.
And so, you know, if Pocan and Jayapal can muster up the bodies to fill these seats... They are, which that's why I love hearing that Cortez would be, Ocasio-Cortez would be on the Ways and Means. That is like a big coup for progressive politics in the one branch of government that the left controls right now.
Sure.
It's like the one sub-branch, really. And I don't know. I mean, I think it's like, it's hard to say that there was some sort of rebuke of progressives in the midterms, and that they are worse off right now than they were 2 months ago.
I mean, I think they are better off, as you point out. I think they should have gotten maybe more from Speaker Pelosi.
Sure.
Or from Pelosi to get her back into the speakership. I think another huge problem for progressives moving forward is that everyone is going to be trying to claim that mantle if for their own political popularity.
Yeah, so that's what we mentioned at the beginning. That's kind of what this political article was about. The headline, you don't just get to say that you're progressive. The left moves to defend its brand, by David Sanders.
And it's important. I mean, we don't necessarily have a concrete platform, but maybe we should have some litmus tests. Maybe that isn't the worst idea in the world.
Well, I mean, there's you can't escape the comparisons, even though I think they're maybe a little inherently flawed, but you can't escape the comparisons to, like, the Freedom Caucus and the Tea Party, who, or shit, even before that, like Grover Norquist and, like, the tax litmus test, spending litmus test, that kind of came about, or rose to popularity in the, with the No New Taxes pledge of H.W.,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's where they were like, oop, yep, we'll take this opportunity.
Yeah, and they created their own litmus tests and held people to account for them. I mean, the Freedom Caucus members the Freedom Caucus members, if you look at the data, don't spend very much time in Congress. A lot of them are one and done, and then move on to, like, lobbying and all the things that they said they hate.
Yuck.
If the progressives want to be a real movement, they need to, like, hold fast to some of these litmus tests, like, hey, no new wars, immigration is fine, I don't know, what are the other ones, Medicare for All, free college, National Savings Bank, or National Postal Bank would be a good one, but I don't think there's that much political will for that one quite yet.
I think some sort of pro-labor stance, but it might have to have a 21st century... I do not know enough about labor law, the history of unions, to anything, but it feels to me, as someone, like most voters who don't know about those things, that there needs to be some sort of, like, 21st century, like, reimagining of unions. But I don't know. Maybe that's just because my mind is poisoned by propaganda for 40 years of against unions.
Well, and the thing about the thing that unions used to provide were adopted by the government. Like, the union demands became labor protections and OSHA and all those great things, which
that's interesting,
are slowly being eroded. And so now, I mean, it's not untoward that progressives are kind of assuming the demands that labor, if it were still in existence, would be making today. That is free education and free healthcare for all.
Good point. Yeah. Yeah, very good point. One thing, though, about back to the Freedom Caucus and the Tea Party, there's sort of like a mixed bag of viewing them as a case study for style. Because, first of all, I very much dislike their politics, you know, their ideologies, so it's hard for me to, like, accurately, or to say, hey, but they do this well. But, I mean, it's easy to point to them having a lot of success with what they want. I mean, not all of their successes, but they've had a lot. But at the same time, they're still kind of a fringe element after 8 years, whereas, in my view, progressives should be not content being a 30% of the Democratic Party rigid block of votes that doesn't get shit done. Like,
or doesn't get shit and compromise when we, like, the progressives have compromised so many times and gotten seemingly nothing for it.
Compromise has to go two directions.
Sure, but if the progressives give every time, then where's the other direction? Yeah, I know.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's, and that's not really compromise. That's just, that's like,
okay. So, so look at the progressives again in comparison to the Freedom Caucus. Like, in 2010, they only got 36 seats.
Okay.
Well, the Republicans, not even the Freedom Caucus, picked up 36 seats. And in this election, the Democrats picked up 44.
Is it up to 44?
Yeah.
Jesus. It's big.
And now, I'm not even sure, but I'm pretty sure there is only like a handful of Freedom Caucus members left in Congress, if any. So, yeah, they were a fringe element that pushed themselves out of power pretty quickly from how unreasonable and just asinine their demands were.
Okay.
And their unwillingness to, govern. But progressives are taking it on. Like, we got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez going into the sausage factory itself to figure out how to make it work for progressives.
Yeah, and she's, like, posting pictures online of how it's getting made. And I don't mean that entirely literally, but actually a little literally.
I mean, they did go to that terrible lobbying meeting.
Yeah, that was fascinating. How many people learned about that didn't know?
I didn't know about that.
I didn't know. Let's just quick. Ocasio, I almost wonder if she knew what it was before she went. I don't know what level of... I don't know. It's not important. So she went to this Harvard-sponsored, conference or...
Like an orientation for Congress people.
And it had speakers, and it's supposed to kind of make them more informed about a lot of policy. Because, most people aren't elected to Congress knowing everything about every issue, right? So notionally, there should be ways to kind of bring people up to speed. But as she pointed out, there were, four CEOs that spoke at it, and,
labor people, no labor leaders. Activists.
And it was, I think there were then other congressmen that chimed in online and all that and pointed out how this has been going on for a long time, this conference, and how it has this heavy slant towards, pro-business.
Jayapal said on Twitter she wished she'd forgotten to warn Ocasio-Cortez and Hillary Rangan about it.
I don't know. And you can see, Pocan recently he's sort of throwing support / jumping on the coattails of Ocasio. I don't mean any disrespect, but onto the coattails of Ocasio-Cortez. But, to me, that's just...
That's fine, right?
Yep, that's exactly how things should be. You shouldn't be, trying to, put out... the shine on one of your brightest stars.
Don't dampen enthusiasm.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I don't even know. Just bogus sort of old school politics might do. But
I mean, and that's kind of why it's easy to make the progressive or the comparison between progressives and the Freedom Caucus because of the solidarity. The Freedom Caucus never really split their votes, and let's hope the Progressive Caucus doesn't split their votes either.
Which is why, going back to, I think, a little bit more rigidly defined platform might be in order. Mm-hmm. And maybe don't address every single topic under the sun on your platform.
Well, maybe don't just, hem yourselves in terms of policy. Just be like, hey, we aspire for Medicare for
That's
all
interesting,
and
college
for all. But don't be like, oh, we're going to do single payer. And it's like, well, maybe single buyer might work, or maybe Medicare for all, or, just don't hem yourself in with a policy.
Yeah. I don't know. Somehow that's almost making me feel like that would be harder to keep votes, though. Like, if you're not getting them to pledge that about specific things, then they might look, when some sort of heat is brought upon individual voters, they might look for any way to weasel out.
Yeah, I get that.
Maybe. I don't know. There's two sides to it, yeah.
Well, maybe they should... I mean, I hope the Progressive Caucus is active and caucuses enough so that everybody's on the same page about what's moving through Congress.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of just, communication, I gather, and relationship building that... politics, right?
Disgusting sausage.
Yeah. But, I mean, it doesn't... always have to be disgusting. To me, that's kind of what Ocasio-Cortez represents. It's a little bit like, why does this have to be disgusting and shady and money-driven? It almost sounds like idealistic Pete on this one. Why does it have to be so bad?
It doesn't have to be, thankfully. And she's showing us it doesn't have to be.
There could be
Crowley somewhere counting his money and not in Congress, so that's a bonus, right?
Well, no, technically he's still there. Soon, right. Yeah, in a week or two, or a month or two. Yeah, and I don't know. No, I mean,
a couple weeks. It's like the 6th of January they get sworn in.
Oh, something. Is it that early? I figured it was later. Okay. Oh, yeah, because I think the House vote is like right after they get inaugurated. Yeah, sworn in. There's the speaker, official speaker vote. Which I've been informed that Kevin McCarthy does not have a pathway to being Speaker of the House.
Really, the Blue Dog Democrats aren't going to like demand more out of Pelosi than the progressives did? That's surprising to me on some level. I thought those, what was it, the Third Way Democrats and the Third Way Caucus was going to split the vote?
No. Yeah, so that's what I think. And I think, like, okay, in my, like, dark fantasy, which, like, in our timeline is often just what happens, but not always.
Yeah, just normal rational projection.
To me, I cannot help but get out the feeling out of the pit of my stomach that a Republican is going to be Speaker of the House. I can't, and I don't have any rational, because again, I've been informed that, well, like, that's not how it would go. Like, you can't win with a plurality. You have to have a majority. So I guess I'm thinking some Democrats vote for him instead of the radical. I don't know. No one said that. No Democrat has been quoted as saying.
Well, they you know what's heading that off, right? Don't you? Nancy Pelosi's insistence on PAYGO rules is the first thing that goes through Congress is what's, you know, keeping her in her speakership position. Because if not for that, I bet those third-way Democrats and some of the quote-unquote centrists would totally peel off for a Republican.
So what does that mean? So that's you have to pay for all of your legislation?
Mm-hmm. And you can't raise taxes on 80% of the people.
Okay.
And there's no way you can pass a tax on the rest because they will spend their money to keep it. So yeah, it's basically tying the hands of Congress for the next 2 years.
So you think that if she were not to have made that promise notionally to the center or right wing of her party, that at least some might peel off and go with the speaker? Like, it's that important?
Yeah. They're afraid of the progressives and, you know, all the quote-unquote money that we're going to spend, but fuck if we don't have enough money for every single war and bomb that we want to drop.
Okay, I know. It's just, like, enough with the enough money. It's like one of the richest governments in the history of the world. And
the Pentagon literally can't account. The Pentagon, a couple weeks it came out, literally makes up numbers for their financial audits. It can't be audited. They've lost, like, trillions of dollars, but we can't afford to feed people.
Wait, but
no rational sense.
Weren't they not? Is that the same as they were not record keeping for their fueling in Yemen?
That's refueling? A whole other separate issue because that's a thorny, complicated set of legal authorizations because there's two different missions in Yemen right now. There's the effort against Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, you know, who sent us the shoe bomber and is widely regarded as one, or perhaps was, as one of the most dangerous splinter factions of Al-Qaeda because, you know, they have a great bomber who's actually sent bombs to America.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an effort against them. If you remember Donald Trump's first major military operation as president, you know, war crimes by the buffet at Mar-a-Lago. They targeted what they thought was Al-Qaeda-held territory, killing a 9-year-old American girl. But this is separate from supporting Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates against the Houthi-led government of Yemen. That's a whole other separate legal authorization. And according to American law, foreign countries that, you know, get our aerial refueling services have to pay for it. And come to find out, what, this weekend, I think it was when it came out?
Yep.
In a letter to one of the senators, I can't remember, the Pentagon basically admitted that it had no idea how much fuel it had dispensed to the Saudi-led coalition at any point. And I love the incredibly diplomatic way they said it. They said that they were unsure if the Saudi government had compensated them for any of it. So we are absolutely directly financing and supporting a genocide in Yemen. And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it, because we're definitely paying for it. And if not for the U.S. Air Force's mid-air refueling services, the Saudi government, or the Saudi Air Force jets and the United Arab Emirates forces wouldn't be able to bomb the targets in Yemen as well as they have been. Not to mention the rearmaments.
I don't think, back to the topic at hand, I don't think progressives, for the kind of specific reasons you are giving about the Arabian Peninsula, I don't think progressives should be afraid to really go hard about Yemen, because to me, the fate lines have sort of been merging on this issue to have it be something that tears off large amounts of Republicans, centrist Democrats, to ending it there.
And right, it's just beyond the pale. Khashoggi's murder aside, there were, the 40 kids who were killed in that bombing?
I feel like if for no other reason, too, I mean, all these factors factor in, but it almost feels like after Khashoggi's murder, the press was obviously very interested. He's a journalist. Mm-hmm. And it was so, brazen and ruthless. But anyway, it seemed like for a minute there, all eyes are just on the ins and outs of that issue, which were tied in with Yemen. And it feels like it was the first time people widely in this country, because there's also, I believe, a really, again, coincidentally timed big report from New York Times with lots of pictures. And
they tried to pull the ground out of, they tried to do what OptiSanitize does.
What is that?
OptiSanitize for the past year or so has been publicizing horrific pictures coming out of Yemen.
Oh, yeah.
And that's what New York Times basically did. Yeah.
And so it just kind of all this timed right, and with some progressives running for office, where all of a sudden people in the country heard about it. They're like, holy shit, we're involved in this terrible, horrific war where there's clearly it's like,
and there's one side with planes and bombs and money galore, and then the other side with starving children.
Yeah, and it's I feel like some people for the first time heard it, because it was sort of whitewashed over by the Obama administration, and then it was just sort of not talked about by Trump, so, it wasn't brought up then. And it finally had a moment to breathe and be exposed to people, and, it hasn't been an immediate about-face, 100%, but there's a lot more support for ending that war, both on the upper echelons of government and amongst, although I haven't seen explicit polling, but I'd find it hard to believe it's not a popular issue amongst kind of just average citizens and voters.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I think you've made the point many times that it's the right thing to do to oppose that war or do something about it for our government. And so it's now, I guess what I'm saying is it's now also the convenient thing to do. Yeah. And I'll be really disappointed if this is not resolved, or angry. if it's not resolved somewhat quickly. And I know it's every day that it goes on is way too long, but...
Well, I mean, that 30-day deadline was supposed to be over, and they're still bombing. Yeah. They're still attacking Hodeidah.
So that's when our Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, I believe, issued a somewhat conflicting deadline, though.
Mm-hmm.
They had different
terms. You have 30 days, and it's okay, yeah, and that's going to pass. Because, again, aerial refueling C-130s are still up in the... maybe the nomenclature is wrong, but the aerial refueling planes are still up in the sky supporting that mission against Al-Qaeda, so, the Saudi planes are still pulling up too, because why the fuck not?
Alright. So, almost as
but this is a good point to end it, because this is one of those litmus tests that progressives need
I agree.
To strengthen their own fucking policy base.
I agree. I think this would be a good kind of first litmus test. Throw it out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over the next...
Make your demands. Like, do some old-fashioned politicking. Wear out another pair of shoes out, Mr. Ocasio-Cortez.
All right. Well, this has been Tell Me What to Think. We just talked about progressives and how they're faring after the 2008 midterms. Find us on Twitter. I'm at Bloated Nemesis. Charles is at green_weird. It's WYRD. Email us, tmwttpod@gmail.com. Go to stoneduckmedia.com or tellmewhattothink.com. Find the Facebook group. Let us know what you think. All right, you have a good week. Later, Charles.
Later, people.
Days are sunny, some days are rain. Destroy the myth and we'll break our chains. Break your chains!